You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why, like you, he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. All so that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialistly. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialistly with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another episode of Girls Know Nothing. I have a really amazing guest with me today. This is Ngozi. If you don't know her, I have been stalking her on social media like I do with all of my guests. And I do have to tell them this so that they don't think I'm a complete weirdo. But for people that don't know who you are, do you want to give yourself a bit of an introduction?
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Ngozi Cadmus and I'm a mental health and leadership expert, a qualified psychotherapist, social worker and business strategist.
Yeah, like a woman with so many like strings to her bow, right? I was like, wow. I thought I'd done everything, but this woman has actually done everything. So, you know, when I was first looking you up on socials, you know, and actually when I was speaking to your people that you are of Nigerian heritage, but you grew up in London. And, you know, I always felt like, well, from my experience, it was a little bit different because I was out of city. But what was it like growing up in London?
I loved it. Overall, I loved it. I love it. I'm a Londoner. I'm a full-fledged Londoner. Oh, anyone over the M25? I don't. you live north of England.
Oh, I always get from Londoners that I live in Wales. That's what I get.
It's like, what's outside the M25? It's like, I don't really recognise. Well, what's going on there? No, yeah, no, I'm a stone cold Londoner, just a stone throw away from where we are right now. But yeah, living in the area that I lived in was very multicultural. Near Dalston, so in the 90s it was very multicultural, and I think it still is quite multicultural now, though it's been gentrified. It is still a very melting pot place to live in. But yeah, I did grow up as a Nigerian British girl. So
was it, do you think it was really nice to be able to grow up somewhere that was a melting pot of different cultures?
Yeah, I guess it's difficult to say how it would be like anywhere else, but I do know that a lot of Nigerians are heavily in South London. So I went to college in South London. So that would have been a different experience if I was brought up in South London or certain parts of South London. So I guess it would have maybe shaped me slightly differently. So I can't say it's any better, because I can't really compare and contrast, but I can say that I did enjoy living in between Islington and Hackney. And when my mum always says, growing up, if not for like the amenities and the adventure playgrounds, she doesn't know how as a single parent she would have survived, you know, because after school, I would go to an after school place. Then she could come back from work at 6 o'clock. Whereas, you know, now people are trying to run from home at 3:30 to collect the kids. Like, it's really difficult. But yeah, it was hard. But she said it would have been really hard though if not for all of those local resources that were available.
Do you think that watching your mum kind of raise you as a single mother and like having those amenities around you inspired you to become a social worker?
You know what? In hindsight, most likely, not in not like
subconsciously.
Yeah. Not like I never wanted to be a social worker growing up. I wanted to be everything. I wanted to be a spy, actually.
Oh yeah, I could see that.
Yeah,
MI5.
Really. Yeah. Oh my god, I actually wanted to be a double agent. I didn't know double agent was actually not a good thing. Like, you know, but I really wanted to be a double agent. I loved James Bond. I loved espionage. I just didn't know how to become a spy, so it was a really big frustration.
So I settled for second best and became a social worker.
Yeah, basically. But yeah, no. When I look back in hindsight, yeah, potentially there's lots of things that factored into me being a social worker. But no, typical Nigerian. I was like, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to be an engineer. But I realized that, yeah, I don't like blood. I didn't know there were other things you can do as a doctor other than like being a surgeon. Then law, my history teacher, I loved history. She said, it takes about 7 years to be a lawyer. I said, nah, I'm not doing university. I'm not doing it that long. So I switched to history. Mom was like, what are you doing with history? I was like, I love history. And then I was doing ancient history. I said to her, I think I'm going to do social work. And she was like, why are you leaving university? I thought, Mom, you'd be happy. I'm doing social work. So I ended up doing social work. And I haven't looked back since, actually. Though I will complete my history degree just because I love history.
I think it's nice, to be fair, sometimes when people are at university and they study something that's like I studied law, you realise you really hate the subject that you're studying and you don't actually want to pursue it. So I guess it's like nice that you found something that you're passionate about. And I, you know, I don't actually have very much interaction with people that work in social work, but I know like at the moment it's very tough to be in that kind of public sector work. You know, what was the biggest challenge that you faced like going into being a social worker?
Good question. Biggest challenge. Biggest challenge of social workers, we don't get paid enough.
Well, yeah, it's preaching to the choir, I think, with everybody that's...
Yeah, I think the demand that we have to deal with, the supply never meets that demand. So there's never enough of us to do the work. And I think the biggest challenge that I had, because I didn't come into social work idealistic. Like, a lot of people have these, like, beautiful aspirations, and then when you start working, particularly majority of us go into the local authority, I went into mental health, everyone kind of gets disillusioned. And I don't know, because my mum wasn't a social worker, but she worked in social care, I wasn't disillusioned. I kind of knew what I was getting into. I think and I'm kind of still in social work. I'm not fully in social work as much as I was a couple of years ago, partly for these reasons. I just don't think we're valued enough. not just by society, that one, definitely not. But we're not valued enough but just by the social work profession. I don't think they valued social workers. And it was quite clear during COVID. I think COVID was my kind of last straw about how I felt we were being treated and being put at risk. So, yeah, I think that's my biggest challenge. Not the work. I don't find the work difficult. But I did not like the way as social workers we were treated by our own profession.
It's very hard for me to like kind of go down into that a little bit more because I don't really understand like how social work really works. But did you ever find that other social workers are going against other groups of social workers in different areas?
No, I never found that. No. I think as a body, generally speaking, if like another social worker came in and said, I'm a social worker today. Like, ah! There's just like this bond. I think it's the same as a psychotherapist or certain professions. You meet people, you just get really excited. I don't know. Or maybe I just get excited. So I've never had conflict with other social workers in that way. Of course, you have work relational issues, like when you're dealing with cases and you may not agree with a nurse or you may not agree with a psychiatrist. That's usually what happens. We kind of have interpersonal issues with other professions because they kind of feel you're the social worker, you should do this, you should do this. It's like, well, no, actually, you think you know our role, but you don't know our role. So when there's kids involved, so I worked in mental health side, for example. So if I'm working with a mother who maybe has bipolar, for example, and maybe she's been like 3-4 years stable, hasn't been in hospital for a long time, has a child, then we're having a meeting around the child, then you have maybe children's social workers who, you know, are doing the best job they can, but maybe without knowing are being quite stigmatised to the mother, saying things like, oh, I just don't think she's a good parent. Like, what do you mean? Can you articulate an evidence why she's not good? It doesn't always have to be with her mental health. It could be just that she hasn't learned good parenting skills. It may not be any relation to her bipolar, but you get a lot of that, like, oh, her mental is affecting her parenting. And it could be, but what is that? Those are some of the challenges that I had. So if I did have challenges with social workers, it was probably from other areas, like children and families, who, of course, they've got to look after the child. But my responsibility is my client, as well as the duty to the children. So those were the issues that sometimes occurred because of different priorities.
Yeah, I guess with being a social worker in mental health, your caseload would have been, ridiculously.
Absolutely
like,
ridiculous.
And I think one of the things that I really admired about your profile and you as a person is that you're, you know, aside from being a social worker and a psychotherapist, is that you're very open about your own mental health experiences and journey. And, you know, was this before you started going into social work? Do you started to experience your own mental health journey?
Since I was a child, I've had difficulties with my mental health. But I think this term is becoming more known. High functioning. So you might have heard people say high functioning alcoholic, high functioning depression. Yeah, that's kind of what I experience. It's more or less that I am highly functioning. A lot of my symptoms are masked or they're in private. You don't see that. It's not the typical, I'm at home with a dark room, not bathing. I'm going to work, I'm doing all those things. I'm still achieving, but underneath I'm, you know, depressed, unhappy, you know, hating myself, self-harming, all of these different things behind that. But I'm more or less functioning to the outside world. So you constantly have a smile. And also with my type of personality type, because I'm extroverted, I'm the life of the party, right? So, I have to hold the group together. And if Ingazi is off, then the whole group is off. So not now, but when I was younger and into my early 20s, it felt like a pressure. I couldn't be quiet. I couldn't be sad because everybody would be wondering what's going on. And then some people would even get irritated because there's a role that you fulfill. And if you don't fulfill that role, everybody else's role was like, what's going on? What's going on? You know, well, why are you not smiling or happy? You know, so it was really difficult to know how to not be performing.
Yeah.
Because that's all I've known, you know, making sure everyone else is good, being a strong friend, right? Looking at, checking out for everybody else. And I was the best deflector ever. So you could ask me, how are you? And the next minute you're talking to me about your life.
I guess like as a young person, that's something that you feel like you have to perform to your friends to be able to keep everyone happy, but you also have like your own struggles of being a teenager anyway.
Tell me about it.
I do find that, like, you know, as a woman, you also feel like feel the need to take on these like feminine motherly roles, even to people that you're not a mother to. So do you feel like that was additional pressure on top of the high functioning depression?
I don't think it was to do with me being a woman. It could be my role. So although I'm an only child.
Sometimes it makes you feel lonely though, right?
If you... Yeah, yes. But it was more that I always had people that I was that were younger than me that I was looking after. It's like, wait a minute, I'm an only child, but why am I responsible for all these little ruffians? So I didn't have that kind of... because when I work with a lot of people that are older siblings, they have that like second mother, second father type thing. But I had that to a degree because all of my cousins and all of the people that I was always around were all younger than me, like at least 1 or 2 years. So I'm the oldest, so I'm, you know, responsible. So I always had that sense of burden to look after people. I think that's where it kind of came from. And I was just aware of, you know, how my personality can change the environment in a positive way, but also the burden can be quite a lot when you just want to be, just be, you can't be you because there's an expectation that you is always happy, always, always happy. And I think also to just give credit to us as teenagers, we're teenagers. You know, at 13, 14, I'm not expecting my friend to understand my depression. I didn't understand my depression. I'm not expecting my friends to be able to, you know, articulate how we could now, like in my 30s. So you kind of realise as a young child, you can't really speak to people about it. And even your friends, you know, we're kind of all in our own world, aren't we? You know, and then we're focused on boys and, you know, teen stuff like dancing and, you know, that was just when YouTube started coming. No, YouTube weren't there back in them days. What were you watching in the 2000s? It was,
YouTube, I think.
Yeah, but it was when it used to do that little thing where like the lines, you remember the lines?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Those used to give me the itches. Someone got the hives. Oh my God, yeah, that was, oh my God, yeah. We were watching the video, it buffered for like 10 minutes. It all be like this. Waiting for like a 3 minute video. So yeah, we weren't doing stuff in school and we should have been listening and stuff. We were doing all of these stupid stuff. But when I really think about it, everyone was going through something. And, you know, that's how when you see now with a lot of the Gen Zs, they kind of start bonding and kind of dangerously start making certain pacts, you know, because they start fueling their self-harming and their thoughts. I'm kind of thankful that I didn't get into that because that's what was happening in the school. Like later on, everyone says, oh, this happened to me. I was like, oh my God, imagine if I started talking to people about what I was really going through. Next minute, I might have been doing certain things. I might not be here because of the connections I would have made with people. But there was other things going on. I was, I used to be bullied. So what kind of, I was saying this to another person yesterday, because I was bullied for like 13 years. When I was 13, I got emancipated and like nobody can bully me. Like I fought these two girls and that was like my emancipation, right? I think from there, my hard shell began. So before I was very like much a pushover. Like if you literally pushed me, I would just fall over. Like if you told me to move, I'd move. From age 13, that couldn't occur. That couldn't happen anymore. So I think that shell, that hard shell kind of became my personality. So it just meant that as well, people weren't able to connect, see my vulnerable side because my persona now was kind of like, you ain't messing with me. Because over all these years I've been bullying. No. You can't chat to me anyhow. So I think that, as well, part of my personality meant that I was never going to be one that was easily connected to in terms of their emotions. You know, I then became strong and protected the defenseless because I felt like because I was bullied, I identified with anybody that I felt like was being picked on or being bullied.
Yeah, I do remember reading about you as well is that, you know, you were able to overcome thoughts of no longer wanting to be here anymore. And was that as a result of, you know, the hard shell and not being able to connect with your own emotions?
Yeah, being bullied. Both physically, I was physically bullied and verbally bullied growing up. And it was just very pervasive because it was everywhere, you know. The only place that it wasn't was when I was doing performing arts. But yeah, up until year 8, being bullied was just terrible because it meant for me, when I think about it now, coming out of my house wasn't safe. The only safe place was my house, really and truly. And my personality has always been how I am now, but was much of a shell of myself, because if you're being bullied by most people, you're not going to show yourself, right? I just didn't feel safe. So for most people, I'm quiet. I was just timid. Those that knew me know I wasn't, but for majority of people, even my teachers, everyone just saw me as quiet Ngozi until Yay. Yay was like the big emancipation. And then no one would ever remember me as the quiet Ngozi, but I remember that because I remember teachers always saying, oh, you're so quiet. Why don't you talk? Why don't you speak to anyone? And then the thoughts, the self-hate. And the thing is, what I would say about being high functioning is that it becomes so normal that you just think it's another part of your skin. That makes sense. And because you're functioning, I'm coming to school, I'm doing all of the things that you just do as a young person, you don't see it as wrong. Yeah. You don't see that, like, the person doesn't come in, oh, they're sick. Why are they sick? Oh, they don't feel good today. Well, I'm still in school, I don't feel good. So you're not connecting with the fact that what you're experiencing isn't normal.
Yeah, I think so. Recently, we just had the year anniversary of a role model of mine who is no longer here, suffered with high functioning depression. And I mean, speaking for, like, I was a woman who comes from an Asian heritage, or even my Polish family, you just don't talk about mental health. You know, you're very emotionless. It's a sign of weakness. Mm-hmm. And part of me does wonder, you know, as she was mixed race, whether that had an impact on her ability to feel like she could come out and speak out about her emotions.
Definitely.
Do you ever feel like that was a struggle that you had as well growing up?
Culturally, yeah, because similar to the Asian community and even probably a lot of Eastern European community, yeah, you just don't talk about those things. And it's also, I was saying this the other day, like in Asia and Africa and even parts of Eastern Europe, the word luxury is not the right word, but you do not have the capacity to be in your depression, if that makes sense, when if you don't work, you're not going to eat. If you don't work, your food is not going to be on the table. If you don't work, everyone will die. And I think that mindset that our families have kind of passes down, because my mom was like that. I think she had high-functioning depression, depressed person, but she was a single parent. If she didn't go to work, I was not going to eat. And obviously, there were times we didn't eat when I was really, really small. My mum, she said that she couldn't continue breastfeeding because she wasn't eating. So I wouldn't remember those times, but there were times where she couldn't eat. So the food that, so she had to give the food to me. So whether you're depressed or not, who's going to pay your bills? And when you come from that mindset, though it is a positive in terms of the hustle mentality, you know, we break through certain barriers, the disadvantage of that means that we don't ever sit down and reflect, or we don't allow ourselves to. We think it's an excuse. We guilt trip ourselves and think, oh my God, how can we complain when there's others having it worse, right? Oh my gosh, how dare I? I should be very grateful, right? So if you grow up in a family, and I think the disconnect between maybe our generation and parents, right? There's a lack of communication, because if parents sat down with their children, children will understand that they come from a different generation. So they're not going to have the verbal equipment to understand you in the same way. Because if they were living in Poland or living in Indonesia or living in Nigeria, nobody would sit down for them. So they've not seen it being modelled. So sometimes we're expecting things from our parents that they've never seen before, right? But our parents are not able to say, look, I just don't know how to support that. So instead of doing that, they're just going, stop crying. Come on, your cousin's back home.
I'll give you something to cry about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I give you something to cry about. Your cousins back home are grateful. If we swap them with you, then we did, you know, all of those things. And then as children, we take it in and we realize that I can't speak to our parents. Or if you do, you try. Next minute, it's all about their struggles and suffering. Oh, you know what happened to me when I came to this country? It's like, okay, this isn't about you. Or they sit there, you cry right in front of them, and they go, oh, what do you want to eat tomorrow? They're not able to connect in that moment. It's too hard for them. However it happens, you feel dismissed.
Yeah. I don't think it's something that I ever realised or understood or could respect about my parents until I was much older. And even now, sometimes when you try to think back to your child and you're like, well, you just don't get it, because children don't. So I guess, like, you know, you are a founder and CEO of a mental health organisation that helps, is it black women?
Black and Asian women.
Black and Asian women be able to connect.
Black and Asian people, sorry.
Yeah, be able to connect with their mental health.
Yeah.
So I guess, did that kind of come as a result of, you know, your own struggles and realising that culturally you couldn't speak about your mental health?
Yes, and because, yes, definitely. yes, even though my therapist that I have to this day 8 years is white, I wanted a black therapist. But then when I met the black therapist, yeah, that didn't work out. But I knew people, it's important people to have that choice.
Yeah.
At least that option, you know. It doesn't always work out. Sometimes the idea you have in your head, sometimes it's just really having somebody who, whatever race they are, understands you. And that's what I found. And most importantly, my therapist, her personality, she's idiosyncratic. And I felt like I had this idea of therapy to be like, you know, like you're in a room, you take your shoes off and you sit down. And that was my experience of when I met this black therapist who I felt like this is going to be like, I wanted her so badly. But when I came into her house, she told me to take my shoes off. And then I said, no, this is not it. And I sat there, she just sat there in front of me and she was quiet. And I was like, this is what I watched in Frasier. Like, this is no. So when I met my therapist, she sat down with her, like, she was just so relaxed. And she was like, I'm white, you're black, let's talk about it. And I was like, I like you, but I'm conflicted. But I felt that, I know that a lot of people, a lot of Asian people, a lot of black people, a lot of people of mixed heritage, just a lot of people that are, I guess, not mainstream white, or not, you know, white British, want somebody who they feel they don't have to over-explain.
Yeah.
Who, if they talk about, you know, they're Muslim and they wear a hijab, not, why don't you just take it off? What? Like, you know what I mean? Like, that understands the racial, ethnic and religious nuances that, you know, you're experiencing. And I think it is really important for people because culture is important to us. Culture is important to us. We're strapped between two cultures, the Western and the East, the Western and African. We want to, you know, remain part of our culture at the same time adopt certain British and Western practices. And we know that we clash at home with that. You don't want to always clash with that in therapy. You kind of want understanding. But I like actually teaching my therapist my culture. It's something that I get something in that, but not everybody has that. Like, I don't want to explain to you why we bow in our culture or why we do this. It's not. I'm not subjected. That's just a cultural thing. That's what we do. You know. So each to their own. But I wanted to create that as an option, because I feel like there's a lack of power that we do have. When you go into the NHS right now, most of the time you won't have choice. You're just grateful for what you're given.
Yeah.
And we are thankful for that. But wouldn't it be nice to say, oh, can I have an Asian therapist? Oh my God, I can. You can request that.
Yeah, I think that's something that's really amazing. I think I have a therapist. I'm very open about having one. And I'm very fortunate that I don't have to explain culture to her or certain practices. And I think that's definitely helped me connect with her, because I think people don't realize that a therapist isn't just somebody you tell your problems to. It's somebody that you should be able to connect with and feel comfortable and be able to talk to on good days, just as much as you can talk to them on bad days.
Yes.
And like, you know, at the moment, I'm on like a high, and people forget that even though you're on a high, you should still be able to talk about your feelings or still have that somebody that you can go back to be able to talk to about your lows. And, you know, I have looked you up on YouTube and seen that you do put a lot of content out there. And one thing that I did find very interesting that I think I always say about men in my own relationships, but that might just be the men that I'm picking to date, but about how you think people should experience some kind of therapy before entering a relationship.
Say that again.
I think there's a lot of people that need to take that practice, like, because they're carrying trust issues and baggage from previous relationships and bring it into the new one, which I do understand, you know.
They're carrying trauma from their childhood.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Into their relationship. People are still complaining from their 16-year-old crush that broke their heart, and that they're carrying
out.
That.
I feel called out.
Oh, shots fired. Shots have been fired.
But I get it. And I think that it's only now that I'm coming closer to my 30s that I'm realizing that it's a detrimental thing to new relationships, not even just romantic ones, but
friendships,
platonic ones,
everything.
As well.
Yes, absolutely. I think the reality is we carry things from our childhood. I just want to tell your audience that you don't have to have massive traumatic events to feel that you can't go therapy. That's first. And trauma is a lasting emotional response. So I love to always give this example, because trauma, we know the big T traumas, the R's, the abandonment, deaths, but sometimes there's cumulative trauma. So cumulative trauma could be maybe your parent is always at work. So you just don't feel like you get that emotional availability. That is traumatic for you. Because as a child, you're not understanding that the economic pressures is taking your parent out of the house. All you understand is my father's never around me. And as a child, you haven't got the adequate capacity to understand all of those nuances. So what do you take it as? Something's wrong with me. Mm-hmm. So without knowing, you make a childish decision in your mind that I'm never going to be in a situation where somebody's just going to leave me, never be there. And then how does that manifest itself out in relationship, detachment styles? It means that maybe as soon as you get close to somebody, you either withdraw back or you become too clingy when you're with someone. Then when you go back, the person's like, well, I didn't really go through that much. Well, no, maybe you didn't objectively, but subjectively, your experience of your parent not being consistent in your life because they had to work for you was very traumatic and made a lasting impression. But what happens is people don't find that out after several broken relationships, and then when they come to therapy, they've now got more stuff to deal with and resolve. And if therapy was seen as like a flu jab, like in schools, that you got the BCG, you know, yeah. You had all of those different things, and given to children, I think there'll be less broken relationships all around, less lonely people, less isolated people, and less toxicity that we see, I think. But because it isn't, and because it's such a societal thing that, yeah, explore relationships when you're very young, well, I don't fully agree with that, because then when you're 30, you are scarred, potentially damaged, confused. And who wants to deal with that? Who should deal with that? Who deserves that? No one. Not your kids, not another partner. So I think if more people, and I say it, I can be kind of say therapy, but I also think if not therapy, any personal development program, whether it's a coach, whether it's a group, anywhere where you're being challenged, anywhere where there's a mirror being held up and your blind spots are being seen and you're teachable and you're being held accountable, if you're not going through that after age 16 and you're just going into different relationships, and that's just, I don't mean romantic only, different relationships, friends, romantic. That's why we see what we see on Twitter. That's why we see what we see between the gender wars. That's why we see what we're seeing. It's because people are building all of their experiences from the different people that they're interacting with who are also equally damaged.
I feel like I needed you when I was like, where were you 10 years ago?
I was depressed. I mean, I was depressed, but, you know, superwoman.
I think, do you know what I always say? Like, it was something you touched on briefly before. I am really grateful that I kind of grew up without the pressures of social media. Mm. Because, like, you know, you were saying, I think it's the same with the way the algorithm works, is that, you know, if you're feeling one particular emotion at a time, you go looking for that type of content, and then once you're in that rabbit hole, it's very, very hard to bring yourself out. And that's why we see the rise of certain types of influencers, and like you were saying, the gender war and things like that. And I feel like, you know, in your darkest days, if you had social media,
that would have been quite scary.
Yeah, and I think, is that something that you're seeing a lot more coming through your doors when you're like talking to other therapists that are out there?
Oh yeah, 100%. Social media, phones. Yeah, all I can say is I'm glad I'm not a Gen Z. That's all I can say. Because the things that I did in school, the stupid things that we did in school, if that was blasted on social media, I wouldn't be here. It was difficult enough to have the whole school gossip about you, let alone all of South London on Snapchat seeing your breast or seeing things that you do, you know, you do things when you're children, right? When you're young, peer pressure and all of this different stuff. Can you just imagine? Because when you're in school, that's your whole life.
Yeah.
If someone said to you, don't worry, in 10 years, no one will care. You're like, I can't even think about next week. Like, all I'm thinking about is me walking down the street and me being called a hoe by people in my school, let alone there are literally young girls being forced to do things. They get videoed and it goes round.
Yeah. And then when it gets online, it's not even just your local area that sees it.
And
it
doesn't matter, once the police gets involved and takes it off, somebody's got it on their phone somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, the damage that does to that person's self-esteem and reputation. The way some young people are, like, what they've got to cope with, I think it's a lot. Now, there's positive things. We know social media's done a lot in terms of, you know, building a lot of economic capital for a lot of people. But I think we have to recognize with the good, there is the bad, right? And I guess it's really important that parents, especially us, because we're now having kids, right? Some people our age have kids that are Gen Zs. The same thing I'm seeing with our generation, our parents' generation, is repeating itself.
Yeah.
I'm not really seeing much difference between, you know, our parents' generation and our generation. And I think a lot of it is down to we're not taking responsibility of our own healing. We're having kids and we're not being responsible for the people that we're bringing into this world. And we can't control the world. We can't control social media as a thing, but we can enable and equip our children with the right tools and languages. But first and foremost, we've got to do that with ourselves.
Yeah, it's like earlier you were saying about how your home was your only safe place, whereas the way that social media works,
some of these people
don't have that safe space at home because it follows you home. So I think it's even more important to really listen to yourself and to be able to, well, you can't form a proper relationship with anybody if you don't form a relationship with yourself. And I'm in a position where young teenagers approach me online saying, oh, you know, how do I deal with a breakup? How do I deal with, like, you know, losing a friend? And I was like, well, you have to focus what you want first before you really decide what the next step is for you. And that's the only way to really deal with it. But I can't, like, you know, I'm saying that because I know in 10 years' time they'll forget about it because I was that person. But like you said, that when you're in that moment,
that's your whole world.
That's everything to you.
Like your whole life is just full of, you know, part. Did you watch Ginny and Georgia?
I've only just got into it. I'm on series 2. I do love it.
Oh, is it?
But I get it.
Yeah. You see what? Yeah. I just finished it yesterday. Like the how teenagers can be. I know people say it's a bit cringy, but that's to a degree how. I wasn't like that fully, but you are in your own world and everything. Breaking up with a guy is like the worst thing ever. Breaking up with your friends is like, oh my God, like, oh my heart. Like, oh my God. So, but then like 10 years ago, I think, oh my God, that dramatic. Was I really that dramatic? But yes, I think it's really, really hard. And I think a lot of young people, they're just not equipped with the language because the parents are not equipped with the language. The teachers are not equipped with the language because they've got so much they're dealing with. They got to deal with the marking. They got to be safeguarding. They got to be social workers.
On top of not being paid enough.
Exactly. And they've got to teach a curriculum. It's hard. I think it's just really hard. I think it's a hard world out there.
I think, so another thing as well that I really admire about you, I'm just your number one fan. But
stop it.
But you're also an entrepreneur and you help encourage other women to be able to start and build their own businesses. Yeah, well, exactly. Starting with their healing first,
yes.
Which I think is very important to be able to get yourself into the right headspace because being self-employed by any means is not for the faint-hearted.
Tell you but, that for free.
Yeah, there you go. That's your first bit of knowledge. But it's like, how did that kind of come about and what inspired you to be able to help other female entrepreneurs?
I think it always comes a bit similar to the questions you get. People start asking you, how did you do what you did, right? When you're doing something successful, and I say successful because everyone's got their different measures of success, but when you're doing something that people are inspired by, then they want to know, how did you do that? Because the majority of the world are living in their comfort zone. The majority of the world are living below their potential. So the minority of people that are breaking barriers and doing things that people are like, oh my God, how are you doing that? They naturally gravitate and ask you questions. So it kind of emerged from there. It's like, I want us women, especially women of colour, to break barriers because shockingly, in my research, because I also did my doctorate, I'm reading a book produced in 1997, and the issues that black minority ethnic women are facing, so black and Asian women are facing, hasn't changed in 20-something years. Like, I'm reading this book, and this was literally published in 1997. She was writing it in 1995, and obviously it took 2 years to publish. And I'm reading, I'm like, are you sure this is not 2023? That's when I was, in 1995, when it came out in 97, I was 6 years old then, I'm 31, and these are the same barriers we're still encountering. Come on. This is absolutely crazy. They're absolutely crazy.
I do want to read it, but I don't think I do. It does terrify me. But I guess, I'm trying to think of what I was going to ask. It's kind of gone off the top of my head. But no, I think it's, for me, what was the best like investment that you've helped kind of get off the ground? Like, what was the best business that you kind of got involved in?
Oh, you mean my business or business I've worked
or
with?
Or like, what was the, as, I had the question in my head, but it's kind of gone. Like, you know, when you help other women set up their own businesses, like what was the biggest achievement that you got to witness some helping somebody achieve?
Do you know what? It's actually intangible. It's their confidence. It's their belief in themselves. It's the, you know, seeing somebody who's like adamant, I'm never going to post online. I'm not going to shame. I'm going to hide. And the next minute they're doing reels and they're doing videos. That's to me the big achievement, because that took me 4 years to be like that. Like, we were talking before the podcast about podcasting and stuff. And I've never wanted to be quote unquote an influencer or quote unquote a person in the camera. I've always wanted to be behind the scenes. And for a lot of people like myself, even though I'm extroverted, to go from wanting to be behind the scenes and actually okay with that to going in front of the scenes, being in camera, being visible, and given the fact you told me about the things that you go through, like the trolls that you have, it's a big step and a big jump. And you don't know how psychologically stuck you feel until you actually go on camera and you go, oh my God, I could never have done this 4 years ago. That's the biggest thing. And I think the biggest thing is hearing, especially young, dark-skinned black girls saying, wow, you inspire me, because I did not think I could ever put myself and show myself because I felt I was too ugly to do that. So yeah, that things like that, that moves me, because I know what it's like when you don't see representation growing up and your representation is told to be less than. So when you see people breaking that, and myself breaking that stereotype or that representation, that image, I think it's powerful.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think when I put myself in front of a camera for the first time and I kind of left away thinking I wasn't the right representation for my people that I should have been, and kind of went on this like long healing journey and that found myself here in front of the camera properly as who I am, as opposed to how I thought I should be. And I guess it was like people like yourself that kind of helped guide me in that way. And I think that, you know, that I do have a lot of young black female listeners, not even just in the UK, but around the world, that would probably really resonate with what you're saying and not feeling heard or represented, and then listening to you and think, actually, you know, there are people out there that you just have to find them. Yeah,
everyone's got a tribe. Everybody's got a tribe. And honestly, the difference between us and people on the other side listening is just we took action and we were consistent. There's nothing better than us. There's nothing, people go, what is it about you? No, there's nothing about me. It's just that I take consistent action. That is the key difference. I could decide, you know what, I'm going to pack it in and not do this. But I have a greater burden. You know, my faith obviously pushes me along. So those watching, I just want you guys to understand that there's no difference. You can sit here and do a podcast. You can sit here and do whatever it is you want. It's just about taking consistent action. Yes, it's scary. You just got to take a risk. And if it doesn't work, then you try again.
Or try something different. It's just redirection at the end of the day.
Yeah, pivot. Like, I pivoted like 100 times.
Oh, it wouldn't, like, it's just the natural part of life, right? But I think, you know, you mentioned briefly about your faith. Sometimes, you know, I come from very religious family members. I personally don't practice the faith, but I feel like my faith had been tested in the past with traumatic events. And do you ever felt like your faith had been pushed to its limits at times?
Not in the same way, but yes. Not in that I've ever felt like I've lost my faith, just more in sense of... Yeah, not that I lost my faith. I've never got a point pushed to the limits of my faith, because God doesn't promise, you know, in the Bible, doesn't promise that things will be rosy. Yes, he says it'll be harder. it's just like, God, does it have to be this hard? I think it's just being believing his promises. So when I'm like, God says in the Bible, there's a scripture that says, ears have not heard and eyes have not seen the promises I have for you. Yeah, but when you're going through a storm, you're like, where are these promises, Lord? Where's the promises? That's what's hard, is believing, despite what you're seeing, that the promises that he has said to you will come to pass. That's what gets tested. Because even now, I'm still going through different things. That's why, think about life. But they always say, you're going into the storm, you're coming out of the storm, or you just come out of the storm. There's always something like that. It's sometimes just believing that things will get better. That's what where I get tested. And I think you asked me a question off camera about like, how has my faith helped my healing? And it has helped my healing. But I know for some people, it hasn't helped their healing. And I think sometimes it's just, you know, and obviously this is more of a personal thing to different people. I've got to talk to different people to understand, what did you learn? What was the doctrines you grew up with? But a lot of it is that there's a very beautiful way that faith and mental health complement each other. But I think with our parents, we have to also understand that sometimes it's not just faith, religion, it's cultural that clash as well. So it makes it very confusing growing up when you grow up, whether it's in a Muslim household or Christian household, and you're just told pray and believe and stuff like that. Because maybe for them, it worked for them, right? It helped them and that's what they knew. But they're limiting God to say that you can't seek help and you can't speak out. Of course you can. Of course you can seek help and speak out. You know, whatever you believe, obviously I believe that God has created the doctors and the therapists. So I believe that's a useful resource. But if you don't have that belief and that faith, then you're going to be told growing up, don't talk to nobody. No, dealing with it yourself. And then you have that comfort and sometimes that resentment to your faith and to your religion, to your culture, because it's been, rather than an enabler, it's been a bit of a suppressor. And like I said, some people have grown up with that. I didn't grow up with that as such, but I did grow up with the cultural thing of you don't tell nobody your business. And it's because growing up in the culture that I come from, if you do tell people your business, it can be used against you. So it comes from somewhere. So when you get older, you understand the cultural, we call it scripting, that you learn, but the context has changed. And the difficult thing with our parents and what we've got to learn is that they went from one continent to another continent with the same patterns, but didn't change the environment, right? The environment changed. You can tell somebody that you're struggling and they're not going to do witchcraft on you. They're not going to come to, do you know what I mean? You're not going to be the talk of the town.
Yeah.
You can do that. But because they're coming from that mindset, you grow up in just don't tell people your business, but that came from a particular location and context that when you did do that, you would be the butt of the village because everyone gossiped and talked about you and you were in one conclave. Whereas you're over here and the person you spoke to is all over across London and the confidentiality is slightly different as it is here than it is in Africa and Asia. So I just wanted to say that because I know there'll be lots of people from different backgrounds listening that may have come back from a religious background and might feel angry and upset. So I think it's important if you do go to therapy to speak about that. If you can with your therapist, whether they share your faith or not, be able to talk about that and explore that, because that's an important part of your life, or was an important part of your life, that you need to explore and resolve.
I think one thing I've always really admired about any religious community is that it is a community and there are people around you. You know, they might not be the same as you, but that's the whole point of having community to support you, especially in your dark days, is really important. I always end the podcast by asking my guests a very similar question. And it's a long-winded question, but I would like to know what would you say to your bully and what would you say to potential doubters in your future doubt how you measure success based on the fact you are a young Black woman?
I would say to my bullies, I forgive you. You're young and you're probably going through stuff because for whatever reason why you chose to bully me, you must have been going through things. I'm sorry that you had to go through what you had to go through and then take it out on myself. So I actually don't blame them. I blame whoever was causing them pain, because the people that caused them pain then caused me pain. Thankfully, I didn't repeat it, but that could have been a repeated cycle, right? And now I'm causing other people pain. And what would I say to my future haters?
Yeah, or doubters.
Future doubters. Suck your mom, no, I'm joking.
That's the soundbite that we wanted right there. I mean, to be fair, I would have left it at that.
What would I say to you? What's the space? So don't hate. You can't hate on greatness. Do you know what I'm saying? You can't hate. What do you say? You can't hate. You got to appreciate. I won't say nothing to you. Just watch it. Basically, what I would say is that you ain't got nothing better to do with your life if you're hating on me, mate, because there's other people you can be hating on. Okay.
I think it was a really mature response that you had in terms of like what you would say to your bullies. I think that that's a lot of thing that people really need to think about, is that forgiveness is a really powerful tool. And, you know, well, whether you believe in God or not, there's always that saying that God will never give you more than you can handle. So you're obviously a very strong person if he could give you all of this and you could take it in your stride.
Yeah, I've hugged my bully. I actually hugged my bully, and a colleague of mine could not believe, oh my God, she really made it a big deal.
Yeah, personally, I probably would not go that far. You're a bigger woman than me. I would not go that far.
Do you know what? Maybe it's because I was bullied up until I was 13. So for me, you were children.
Yeah.
I don't think I would hug the person that bullied me when I was an adult in work. If I saw you, don't have any anger towards you, but yeah, you ain't getting no hug. Okay?
I would definitely cross the street if I saw you. But I really appreciate your honesty and your openness. And I know that a lot of the people that are listening will as well, because it's not easy to talk about. And especially on a platform where anybody can listen, you've made yourself incredibly vulnerable. And yeah, I really appreciate everything you do. And thank you for coming on my podcast.
No, thank you. Well, I've got time today for any trolls, yeah?
I've got time, yeah. Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.